I think that it is fair to assume on my part that the audience today is sympathetic to the proposition that memory or history is of relevance for the present and therefore for the future. I have to say though that this is not in such an environment this is accepted, this is understood, but this is not at all considered to be the truth everywhere. And in the particular case that I'm going to be mentioning to you, which is the case of Iraq, actually memory is considered more often than not to be destructive, to be basically a subject of rejection. The solution that is often presented with regard to memory is, why don't you simply turn the page and move on into the future as opposed to delve into memory. As a matter of fact, what I'd like to do is, this is a very narrow case study compared to what, for example, Istvan or you presented. This is the case study of one particular situation, Iraq. I'd like to present it to you both in substantive and structural terms with the hope that in both cases, meaning in both components of my presentation, there will be something of a far more, let's call it universal or general value as opposed to it being restricted really to Iraq. In terms of the substantive component, Iraq lived and is still living very much so a traumatic experience. And countries that have, societies that have faced a similar level of trauma, whether on a sustained, if you like, low intensity trauma, again, low intensity, this is a very subjective assessment, but nonetheless, such as Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, or more intense, high intensity trauma, such as Cambodia, for example, have dealt with their legacy of terror, with their legacy of horror in different ways. Usually the two extremes that we put on a spectrum in terms of trying to figure out what would be valid or valuable or useful for Iraqi society are the extremes of Lebanon, where I come from, and South Africa. In the case of Lebanon, a 15-year civil war ended in Lebanese society deciding indeed to turn the page. When at some point in Lebanon I thought that memory was being denied, I found out as a result of probing that memory was not denied. To a large extent, memory was rejected. Memory was refused. This was one example, and I'd like to footnote Lebanon later on because developments that happened very recently actually changed that very assessment. At the other extreme, we have South Africa with the process, the Truth and Reconciliation process, which many people would be critical of it, many people would underline its shortcomings, but nonetheless, it was in principle a process of complete openness, as opposed to a process, an event of complete closure in the case of Lebanon. Our idea was always that, meaning the group of people that ended up forming the Memory Foundation, that it is, while having a point of view, while having a position with regard to the matter, it is not our right to impose that point of view on Iraqi society. What our duty was, what our mission was, is to create the tools to enable Iraqi society to choose between these two extremes and advocate at the same time what we consider to be of value, which is one of openness, of confrontation. And I'd like very briefly to underline to you why we consider it to be of value. To a large extent, Iraq, like actually most nation states in the Middle East, was a nation created out of need. More or less. By that I mean, okay, some administrator somewhere decided to slap together a number of provinces and it gave it, they gave it a name. I mean, this is true in the case of Iraq, true in the case of Jordan, which actually Churchill brags about having drawn a principality out of the map, meaning at random. This is true in the case of Israel, that did not exist before. It's true in the case of Lebanon. It's true. I mean, much of the Middle East, not Egypt, mind you, but much of the Middle East has a history in terms of a nation state that is very much so recent. However, 85 years of nation state history is not something that you can cancel. What we have is, over the years, what starts as being an artificial creation becomes the reality, and very much so we have a national narrative developed in Iraq, and therefore we have, I mean, most Iraqis that you talk to of a certain generation, of a certain upbringing, of a certain living in a certain place, in this particular case being Iraq, would tell you, yes, we did feel as Iraqis, we were Iraqis, this was our national identity. However, the liberation invasion, call it what you may, of Iraq comes with an agenda. Actually an agenda which is to a large extent parallel to the agenda of the regime itself. The regime, the Saddam Hussein regime, confiscated the national narrative. Becoming Iraqi, being Iraqi became being a supporter of Saddam Hussein. So with the fall of Saddam Hussein, the national narrative vanished. And instead, what we have, and this is largely driven by those who came with the liberation, invasion, occupation, whatever you want to call it, what we end up having new factional narratives. People who are arguing, and I'll just mention to you a few of them just in order for you to get a sense of what we're talking about. No, we're not Iraqis, we're Kurds. Actually, as Kurds, we are the largest community in the Middle East that does not have the right for self-determination, and we have been persecuted by Arabs throughout history. We would like our state. This is one narrative. Another, no, we're not Iraqis, we're Shiis, and as Shiis, we have suffered 1400 years of Sunni oppression, and it is time for us as the majority to rule. This is the second narrative. No, we're not Iraqis, we're Sunni Arabs, and as Sunni Arabs, we have been the driving force behind the existence of Iraq and well beyond, and now we are unfairly being marginalized. Third narrative. No, we're not Iraqis, we're Assyrians, and as such, Christian Assyrians, we are the original inhabitants of the place, everyone else is a newcomer, and we are entitled to our state. And I can go on and on and on. The fact of the matter, there is a kernel of truth, clearly, naturally, in every one of those. However, what every one of those does is reduce, simplify the history that was, especially the history of those 80 years, and view it in a context that is suitable for this factional narrative. To a large extent, what we're doing is not providing, not creating an alternative narrative. It's not our job, it's not our function. We are laying bare the facts to the extent that facts can be laid bare. I mean, we can get into a whole argument about whether there is such a thing as historical objectivity. Regardless, we're laying the facts bare for others in that society that would like to argue for an Iraqi identity or for a liberal democratic identity or for a humanistic identity to be able to get back to those facts and use them, get back to those documents and use them. For example, I don't want to debunk all those narratives, but just as an illustration, indeed, the Kurdish population of northern Iraq was subjected to a horrible genocide in which no less than 150,000 people, maybe 300,000 people, were massacred by the regime. However, what is often omitted in saying that is that many Kurds participated in that massacre. So all of a sudden, the national dimension of it is diluted and other dimensions creep in. Actually, it is not our business to sort, although, I mean, actually, we do quite a bit of that, but really, the main purpose is to bring to the fore these documents. And the way we've decided to do it, now I'm moving from the substantive to the structural, is by basically trying to tell the story in three ways. Tell the story of, basically the convergence of these three tracks will end up telling the story. One way is collecting the whole universe of documents that were produced by the Saddam regime. By that we mean every single piece of paper that the Saddam regime scribbled, or typed, or computer printed, or whatever. And this sounds ambitious, and actually it is, and we are, in a certain sense, maybe too ambitious for our own good. We estimate the number of such documents to be in the vicinity of 400 million. This is done on the basis of some guesstimates, if you'd like, upon guesstimates, so please, I mean, indulge me, the number is not necessarily that accurate. However, we have collected so far 11 million pages of such documents, and therefore we're not talking about a high percentage, but it is one order of magnitude away from it. Okay, so we're working our way, and actually we are in discussions with that one party that holds the majority of those documents, by that I mean the US government, to hand to us at least access to them in order for us to incorporate it into our data bank, basically. However, this is one track. Another track, because this is just dry paper, another track would be the testimonials, the memories, the oral memories of people who have participated. And in there, actually, we cannot hope for comprehensiveness. We have 25 to 28 million Iraqis, and clearly we're not going to interview every one of them, but our intent is not to be representative either. Our intent is to collect as many accounts as possible, each account standing for itself and for the whole collective of Iraq, not for its own community or for its own village or for its own religion or ethnic group. And our efforts there are very modest. We have only succeeded so far in recording 50 such short films, but amounting also we're collecting all sorts of audio and video material from the time of the regime, including horrible, horrible tapes about torture. And here I'll get to something else actually that justifies both types of collection. This was a totalitarian regime, and as such, like virtually every other totalitarian regime, obsessed with documenting itself to a large extent in order for the underlings, if you'd like, to prove to those higher-ups that they have done the job, or for the higher-ups to show the underlings what they can do. But regardless, the documentation is there, and we're engaged in trying to bring it in. And the third track that we hope the three will converge together is basically the artworks and artifacts produced by the regime in order to visually colonize society and semiotically invade and completely obliterate any personality, any individuality, and impose a vision. Actually, I have to tell you here, looking into the material, this is like a fantasy land for one person. This one person being Saddam Hussein, he had a country and he could dream of anything, and that anything becomes a reality. I mean, he flips the newspaper, a newspaper that has a readership of one, because the newspaper was written for him. Others may or may not read it, it does not matter. Everyone working at the newspaper would work with the hope that Saddam would read them, not anyone else. He would see a cartoon in the newspaper, he would say, I'd like that to become a monument. Days after, months after, it becomes a monument. So gradually you see the city had transformed itself, it's like morphing itself into that fantasy vision of Saddam. So, and now, not surprisingly, the moment Saddam is gone, the inhabitants of the city, the inhabitants of Iraq would like to obliterate that atrocity, okay, and restore back what they had. Nonetheless, we would like to sample that, meaning we would like to save that and the reaction to it, and we're doing it. And the convergence of these three tracks, we hope, will end up becoming, I mean, we're very much so inspired in particular by many institutions, but I'll cite one which was of relevance in terms of transforming material that otherwise would be dead into an active and interactive, I would say, experience. I'm talking about the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And while we are aiming for something that is very much so Iraqi in texture, in flavor, but nonetheless, the interactiveness that we seek is akin to what you see at the Holocaust Museum. Now, that process has led to friction. A friction with some groups, and we're trying to deal with that. If we are to define ourselves as an archive, which we do not, we would come into immediate conflict with the National Archives of Iraq, which is trying to restate itself, redefine its mission, and engage that mission. So it has been our position throughout that our mission is complementary to that of the National Archives. We do not supplant it. Actually, what we try to do is derive use out of the documents in novel ways. And this is actually the purpose, and the purpose is not the documents themselves. A document is artifact and content. What our concern is the content, while ensuring ultimately that the artifact will get preserved. And this is where we can be helpful. I'll be glad to answer any questions later.
Question, just to clarify, Hassan, you're talking about your country, Lebanon, also, not just Iraq. When you say that memory has been rejected, you only mean a period of time. You don't mean all of memory. Mm. Is it possible that a period of time that memory has been rejected in favor of an older memory of what Lebanon was?
Actually, I'm glad that you're asking me to write that footnote that I mentioned, that I had to write about Lebanon. As a matter of fact, memory was intensively, the memory in question is the memory of the traumatic period. It's not an overall memory. It was rejected for what turns out to be a period of 15 years, or roughly one generation coming of age. And now that it has happened, meaning after the assassination of Hariri and the whole, there's a whole resurgence of insistence on coming back to that traumatic period, not to relive it, but to deal with it, to interact with the other about it in order not to have it happen again. So as a matter of fact, that rejection of memory lasted 15 years. It did not last forever, but we started the work on Iraq while it was still in place. Mm-hmm. I find the parallel very interesting with Cambodia. I went to Cambodia and actually realized one thing. I mean, we have an organization that's very much so a sister organization because we deal really with the same issues, the Documentation Center of Cambodia. And I noticed something about the Documentation Center of Cambodia. It has 50 people working like in a beehive, all of them intensely working and devoted to making truth, I mean, bringing the truth out of the Pol Pot experience. I noticed something about them. They were all young, extremely young. And I started asking, what about the generation that actually lived the experience? And basically, these were the children of that generation. And their answer was, they do not want to hear about it. They want simply to turn the page and move on. There seems to be, again, I mean, I'm not saying, therefore, we can say here there's a template that is applicable everywhere, but there seems to be a tendency for some societies, to deal with trauma by postponing dealing with it up until it is ready to deal with it. That's the case of Cambodia. It seems to be the case of Lebanon. And therefore, our work is foundational work in the case of Iraq in order for that, when that society, when that generation is ready to deal with the traumatic past, it will be able to deal with it on the basis of actual documents as opposed on the basis of narratives that are factional narratives for political purposes.